Yes, I wanted to share with you something that basically came across my bow, as they say in nautical world, because I've been reading the numerical discourses, which are pretty fascinating. And does anybody know what the numerical discourses are, or does anyone not know? Sort of maybe, yeah, a little bit. So it's one of the four Nikayas, the four primary Nikayas collections of the Buddha's, of the suttas, the Buddha's teachings, and the numerical one is delightfully odd because it's organized in terms of how many items are in each sutta. So like the threes, I'm in the threes right now, and every sutta has three of something in it. So I'm in the book of threes, and every sutta is about three somethings, whatever they are. Sometimes there's debates about how many, whether this should be in the fives or the threes, because it's a little ambiguous. But it's pretty cool. But what's interesting about these, just what's interesting about the suttas, sometimes the Buddha will come up with this unique angle on what we're up to on the path. Because he was talking to somebody. You know, somebody asked him a question and he's having a conversation. They're all conversations he had with actual human beings who were coming from different places and will frame things differently. That's what we were just talking about, the connected discourses. And they kind of like, there'll be a big theme, but there's like all these different angles because he's talking to all different people. So it's really interesting to see what clicks. And I sometimes get this feeling, and I've had this around some highly awakened beings sometimes also, that they sort of see it and they're trying to figure out how to explain it to us. I mean, Joseph is like that. Joseph Goldstein, you know, I'm not saying he's awakened or not, I don't know. But he sees really deeply, and you can see him trying to like figure out a way to get through to you, us, and make it clear. You know, and the Buddha's like that. He's just trying to, that which is totally clear to him, he's trying to get it through to us or the people who are hearing him. So I think it's really wonderful. And he's always driving at that ultimate freedom, you know, that ultimate letting go. He's delightfully incessant about that. And that's part of the like mystery of the Dharma, you know, it's like it's obvious to him, it's hidden to us. How do we work with that? How do we move in that? So, yeah, and just sometimes there's these gems that I find really useful, and I try to keep my antenna up to see what might land, and I thought this one would. So it is in the Book of Threes, and he says, "So too, monastics, these are the three urgent tasks of a monastic." What three? One, the undertaking of the training in the higher virtuous behavior. Two, the undertaking of the training in the higher mind, and three, the undertaking of the training in the higher wisdom. These are three urgent tasks of a monastic. And I kind of love that, because for one thing, I've never heard him, you know, I might be wrong, but I've never heard him use the phrase urgent tasks in that way, you know, in reading. So that's interesting right there. And this is like a little bit like the three higher trainings, but it's sort of different too. It's sort of a unique, it seems to me, formulation. So I thought we could just, I'll offer some little work on it and something that might be helpful, and then we'll see where we go and see if it's helpful. Because what's cool about it is it's so succinct and it's kind of doable. I'll read it again. Three urgent tasks of a monastic. What three? The undertaking of the training in the higher virtuous behavior, the undertaking of the training in the higher mind, and the undertaking of the training in the higher wisdom. These are the three urgent tasks of a monastic. Here, I'll put it up in the chat, and I bet if you search for it, it's a Bhikkhu Bodhi translation, but you'd be able to pick up the part of it where it is because of the wonders of the internet. And as an aside, with much reluctance, I finally caved, and I've been investigating AI. And a friend of mine taught me how to use it a little bit, because you tell it what you want it to be, and then you ask a question. And if you say to AI, "You are a Theravada scholar," and then it says, "Oh, I'm happy to help you with being a Theravada," and then you ask it about a particular sutta that you read, and where is it? It's like there was one I couldn't remember, and it just nailed it. And it had the citation, this and MN whatever, and so, just saying. But don't let it write for you. That's my only thought. Okay. I am. Yes, but thank you. All right. So what's cool about this little thing is it's very succinct and kind of doable. Like you could stick it on your refrigerator and it's totally pointed at awakening. And I think it's really something we could work with. You know, it's a way, like an angle, you know, kind of an angle to think about the journey. So I'm going to take it apart a little bit. And so there's urgent. That urgent is so interesting. Why is it urgent? Because we were sort of just talking about it. You know, there's sort of the carrot and the stick aspect of the Dharma. And the carrot part is what's possible, you know, that we can awaken, that we can find a unfathomable peace, not touched by conditions, and a vast love embracing all beings through doing this. I mean, that's just possible. So that's urgent. And we can see the nature of reality as it is, as the Buddha did. So, wow, that's incredible. The Buddha said, "May I, with the destruction of the taints in this very life, realize for myself with direct knowledge the taintless liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom, and having entered upon it, may I dwell in it." So that's kind of what's offered to us. And we all, you know, we all have some of that already. It's not like it's far away and this distant thing. We're all, anyone that's practicing regularly has some of that. And if you, you know, compare it to your friends and colleagues who may, say, in some situation be completely hysterically wrapped up in it or just identifying with it completely or whatever, there's a space that everyone that practices with some depth of sincerity starts to have where they're not. So they're on the journey. They've moved in the direction that he's talking about. The taintless liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom, with the destruction of the taints. Tall order to be sure, but we're on the way. And, you know, we all run into stuff. We feel torn. We feel suffering. We feel bleak. But it doesn't have to be where we end up. It doesn't have to be who we are. It's just something that's coming up right now. I go through bleak moments for sure sometimes, and I gotta, you know, okay, bleak moment, work with it. But it doesn't have to be. That's not it. I was going to tell you a little bit about one of my very first teachers, Venerable Genla Rinpa, who I sometimes mention. He was a Tibetan Lama in the Gelupa tradition. He was on his way to becoming a Geshe, which is basically a PhD, and he dropped out. Right at the kind of almost the last minute, he dropped out because he realized once he became a Geshe, he was going to get pulled into the monastic hierarchy structure and have to be an administrator and teach people and all kinds of things. And he just wanted to practice on his way to enlightenment. So he came to Seattle twice. He came in 1988. In fact, for those of you who've been to Cloud Mountain, Diamond Hall was built for a year-long shamatha retreat of 12 people in those rooms that he led. He came over to lead a one-year shamatha retreat. So that's why that was the origins of Diamond Hall. And I went over there in 1991 and did a three-month retreat in a little hut at Tushita, which is kind of about a mile through the forest to his hut. And he was just, I guess, I would go over on Wednesday afternoons. I don't speak Tibetan, but there was an Australian lama, Western guy who spoke fluent Tibetan, and he would come up and he would translate. And it was just kind of one of the most astonishing little three-month periods of my life back then. And but the point being, he was so happy. I mean, technically, he was living in the thing was like, I don't know, 8 feet by 8 feet. This little stone hut scrunched up in the forest. And he was just this incredibly happy person. I mean, he was highly awakened, basically. He was highly awakened. He just saw. He lived in another space than most of us. So I just share that with you because, you know, it's one of those things that's in my bones that I know, kind of know what our potential is. And he was very patient with me. But, you know, it was that honoring of potential. That's what Dalai Lama does, you know, just honoring all of us strange farangs. Yeah, we got the same thing. And so I say that to be encouraging. And, you know, the stick part, carrot and stick, right? That life is so short and the possibility of freedom is fleeting. And this is a time to grab it. And you know, I mean, I from the Tibetan part of my practice is much more emphasis on rebirth than in Theravada. It's much more like how you think about things, how you orient yourself to your practice. It's much more in your face. So I think about it quite a bit. And you know, even if rebirth is true, we don't know where we're going to be next time. I mean, here in 2024, we're in this very mellow part of the world. We're not in the middle of a war. We're not suffering extreme overheating that are taking out people in Delhi and parts of the world that are, you know, if we're reborn 50 years from now, it may be horrendous in many parts of the world. And if we're reborn in the Sudan, just by some happenstance or whatever, you know, our chance of encountering the karma, the dharma, or even kind of surviving, will be relatively slim. So that's part of the stick. You know, just get it while you can, or grow as much as you can. You've had the opportunity to you know, meet teachers and practice together, and it's amazing. So I kind of really take it seriously. I mean, I do feel a certain fire in my heart about this because, you know, I mean, either I'm going to die and it's over, there's that, or I'm going to come around again, and I'm not, you know, feeling all glisteningly happy about the future. But if we came around again and really had some solid attainment when we came in, we might really be able to help people. You know, we might be able to have some equanimity in the middle of difficulty. So there's a stick. In terms of there's a possibility, and you know, the not to waste the time. It's urgent. That's why it's urgent. And the Buddha, now in terms of those three, virtuous behavior, higher mind, and higher wisdom, the Buddha says, as this bhikkhu trains in the higher virtuous behavior, the higher mind, and the higher wisdom, there comes an occasion when his mind is liberated from the taints by non-clinging. So it's just this beautiful little summation. And by the way, I kind of plucked these things out of different parts of this sort of area of the three, so it's not one sutta. It's kind of, they kept this theme kept being amplified and worked on. So that's kind of where this is coming from. So training in, it's a hierarchy, right? It's clearly a hierarchy. Higher virtuous behavior, then higher mind, then higher wisdom. There's a hierarchy there, and that's part of what we can work with it. And training in higher virtuous behavior is really, I think it's really a wonderful formulation because it's so simple. It's just so simple, and it tells us where to go and why. And it's not like worrying about the finer points of the five precepts. It's just training in higher virtuous behavior. It's a plus. You know, it's something to do rather than things not to do. I mean, they all go together, but this is a way to look at an ethical life that is actually really, you can work with it. It's pretty cool. You can work with it. And behavior, what is that? You know, it's actions of body, especially because this is in the arena of body in particular. Choices we make, because this is the first of the three, and the Buddha always starts with body. But as we'll see, they overlap. And they kind of interconnect as it gets subtler and subtler. But let's just say we're starting with body, just what we do, you know, the choices we make, the actions we do. And just think of them as higher virtuous behavior and then see where your choices take you. I think it's a really nice, I sort of try to do that anyway, but it's a much more kind of like additive way of approaching it rather than avoiding the bad stuff. It's just doing the good stuff. Because the precepts, I mean, I'm not saying it's a problem, but sometimes it seems like the things it's suggesting we don't do might be fun. So it can be kind of it can feel like a buzzkill. You know, like self-denial or renunciation and all those kinds of questions. And is this really, and how do we think about that and all that? But there's a kind of an emphasis on the not doing something that's bad sila. But in this, the phrase of the emphasis on the positive, a higher and virtuous behavior, you can just really just take that and see where it takes you. Because it means being kind. It means being good to people, you know? It means uplifting. It's just simple, simple, simple. See what it means to you. And it also takes us towards light and freedom. You know, it takes us away from the tangle of grasping to self, to caring for others. So it's just it's a really sweet, sweet structure. And there's some joy to it. Like, what's not to like, you know? Higher, virtuous. It's fun. So you don't have to worry about what you're not getting. Just have fun doing it. And, you know, we all know that when we act out of generosity, when we actually have virtuous behavior, which generally means for the welfare of other beings, whether they be humans or four-leggeds or whatever, we're lifted. We're lifted up. There's, you know, when you give to someone, light comes back. You sort of move yourself into the realm of mutual light. And it's an uplifting and a clarifying of mind. And this is where it gets interesting, because those actions that we take, you know, we can think of sila or ethics as a separate kind of thing we're doing, but actually it's completely linked to our state of mind. And this sort of makes it clearer how the things we do, this higher virtuous behavior, lands right exactly in our state of mind. It's what helps. And if we do this, you know, we cultivate that, we won't steal from people if we're cultivating higher virtuous behavior. We won't abuse them. We won't, you know, break sexual misconduct boundaries, any of that stuff. We won't put our own pleasure in front of someone else in any way, because it's higher and virtuous and helpful. So it kind of brings brightness to our lives in body and mind. And that's a stepping stone to awakening, because that's what awakening is brightness in body and mind. You peel away all the obscurations and we wake up. So this is a way to kind of, in day-to-day, moment by moment, just a beautiful sort of phraseology to work with, how we can cultivate that and bring that brightness in. And I sort of, in my own life, you know, kind of, how do I say, trying to make choices about what to do, I ask this, how can I grow, how can I give, is this little mantra I do to myself. Just keep asking, how can I grow, how can I give, and see what comes up to do in the moment-by-moment choices of life, or the planning of priorities, or what I take on and what I don't take on, or what I get involved in or don't. And it's very connected to this. Because how can I give and how can I grow are completely interlaced. And when we choose in that way, it moves us towards light, and it moves us away from bondage. So, you know, that's sort of why I do whatever funny role I have with Insight. That's what I do it, because, I mean, I'll confess I enjoy doing it with you all, but also I'm really aware that it makes a difference to people. You know, I've heard that from people, and how cool is that? I mean, I could be doing all kinds of silly stuff instead of this. So this is just, it's a joy, you know, but it is a sense this is a higher virtuous behavior. It's part of what, you know, keeps us going on here. So the next step in this little trio is undertaking the training in the higher mind. And this is really interesting. And he's sort of dancing around. I even talked to Ajahn Nisibo about that, because in different parts of this little chain of suttas, he describes this training in higher mind in two different complementary ways. And it took me a while to get my head around it. Because the first is kind of like day-to-day training of mind, cleaning of attitudes. And you can see how it's connected with higher virtuous behavior. And then the second, despite what it says on my notes, the second is the absorption in samadhi, the jhanas. The settling of mind into that depth of presence. But that's interconnected with the first, because the first we can really work on. You know, the jhanas and samadhi work for some people, not for others. Right now, who knows? But to see the connection, I found it really, really helpful. So in terms of the first, there's actually this very interesting little description the Buddha says. It says, when a monastic is devoted to the higher mind, then you listen. There's three things. The first is there are in one. I'm trying to figure the wording. There are in one gross defilements, bodily, verbal, and mental misconduct. Something's not quite right there, but anyway. The first aspect of cultivating higher mind is looking at the gross defilements, bodily, verbal, and mental misconduct, and earnest, capable bhikkhu abandons, dispels, terminates, and obliterates them. When this has been done, then there are middling defilements, sensual thoughts, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of harming. And an earnest, capable monastic abandons, dispels, terminates, and obliterates them. And when this has been done, there remain subtle defilements, thoughts about one's relations, thoughts about one's country, and thoughts about one's reputation. And an earnest, capable monastic abandons, dispels, terminates, and obliterates them. When this has been done, then there remain thoughts connected with the Dhamma. So this is so cool. It's like a peeling away process he's describing in terms of cultivating higher thoughts. And if you go through this hierarchy, it's pretty interesting because the gross defilements, bodily, verbal, and mental misconduct are very tied into the thing we were just talking about in terms of virtuous behavior. It's the opposite of that. And you can see how they're a bridge in this little set of three. It's just a different way of looking at it, but not doing these gross defilements. And the middling defilements of sensual thoughts, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of harming, which is essentially the three poisons in a sense, grasping, aversion, ignorance out there, not quite, but anyway, grasping and aversion, two of them. And, we get stuck there in our minds, in our thoughts, where our thoughts are. And the flavor of our thoughts, we get stuck because sensual thoughts can be alluring and promising pleasure, hard to let go of. But if we have this momentum of higher virtuous behavior, it makes the letting go easier. Because you sort of realize often it's at someone else's advantage that we would pursue those, or it would take our attention away from being with the people we connect with, all kinds of things. You just indulge in too much of that stuff and it takes you over away from now. And then thoughts of ill will and harming, that's more clearly obvious, not helpful, not virtuous behavior, don't benefit anybody. But kind of look at it as how we cultivate our minds. A way to look at this is just a flavor, the tone of our minds and what we're doing with it, and how this is part of the multi-step direction of awakening. So this is all tied to awakening, even though this stuff seems like more mundane life stuff, but it is. So we work with what we got, where we are. And it's so interesting, these subtle defilements, thoughts about relations, thoughts about country, and thoughts about reputation. And, there's the difference here. I think what he's getting at is they're relating to the ways that we're selfing around those things. Because the Buddha does, talks about his relations, talks about his son in the suttas, thinks about the monarchies that he was around. I don't know if he exactly thinks about his reputation. I don't think he does that exactly, but, he does talk about these things. It's not inherently bad to talk about those things, but the way we hold it in terms of colorations, how we adhere to those things and make them me and mine, and then make separation, and then make other, and all those problems that arise. So it's subtle defilements, how we are with those things. But when you look at them that way, in this sort of hierarchy, it can give us a fresh way to not be stuck. I guess that's part of what I think is worth, why this is worth going through. A fresh way to not be stuck. And to look at the ways in which we're subtly attached that might miss us. And especially because in our culture, it's almost like being attached is, a virtue. If you look at professional sports, it's all about being attached to your team and wanting to defeat the other ones. It's like, really? So, yeah, it's kind of like that. I think it permeates our world too much for people to think about winning, winners and losers, and want to crush the losers and all that stuff. It's all concretized. It's way too, it's sad, sad, sad. So, awakening comes from insight, seeing the nature of things. But cultivating wholesome states of mind and diminishing unwholesome states of mind is a support to insight. It's part of what helps us get there. And it's part of what helps us have deeper practice. Because the stuff that tugs us away and distracts us, it's all churning around in there. And often it's all kinds of subtle attachments and identifications and telling us the story of ourselves over and over, and the things we regret and the things we wish and the things we don't like and all that stuff, which is there. But to be able to just hold it lightly, and work with it, as the Buddha's talking about here, can help us get deeper in our practice. You know, they say you can't get the jhanas if the five hindrances are still present. You have to get past them to get the jhanas. And so this is the way to work at that. The way to work at that. And he refers it as project as sort of a unpeeling. I said a nasty banana. But anyway, he says, when this has been done, then there remain thoughts connected with the Dhamma. The Dhamma. So when you get rid of all this other preoccupations, what remains is thoughts connected with the Dhamma inherently, because it's not sticky. So we're sort of unpeeling the sticky and being aware of it when it appears. It's kind of a beautiful way to think about that. And then that's where, you know, the second higher mind aspect that he talks about in this little collection is, in fact, the ability to do the jhanas, to be able to be an absorption in the moment, just completely present. And then one can do insight practice from that basis, and that's a good place to go. Beth Upton, some of you crisscross paths with Beth Upton. She's quite an extraordinary woman practitioner who was a, she practiced, she was a, I think 10 years she lived at Do you know the name of that monastery in Burma? I can't think of it. Anyway, it's losing me right now, but very focused work on the jhanas, and she's one of these people who could do it. And she started this off, she's British, getting a degree in economics at Cambridge or something. So a super smart person, and it just somehow the Dharma got her. She dropped out, went and did this thing, very skeptical, very scientific, very worldly mind. And she was, I saw this incredible interview, which if anybody's interested, email me and I'll try to send it to you if I can find it, that was done in Burma by another practitioner. So it was like literally done in Burma, the interview was face to face, and they recorded it. And she was saying that she was absolutely convinced there weren't such things as past lives. Didn't think there was, Dave is ridiculous, what are you talking about? And then when she got, because of her own karma, whatever, she was able to get in incredibly deep states of the jhana. And she said, oh, she all of a sudden started seeing her past lives, which completely startled her, but there they were. And then she was meeting devas, which completely startled her, but there they were. So we have that possibility. It's nice to know we have that. But this work we're talking about, it clears the air to go into deeper and deeper areas of where this journey can take us. So even though insight works in the middle of the mess, in the middle of a discussion with your spouse, in the middle of, you know, your mind feels like it's just a rotor-rooter, mindfulness works there, so it's okay. But at the same time, the more we can cultivate stability in mind, there's also that possibility of going farther and deeper than we could imagine, as it was for her. The Buddha said, there comes a time when one's mind becomes internally steady, composed, unified, and concentrated. That concentration is peaceful and sublime, gained by full tranquilization and attained to unification. It is not reined in and checked by forcefully suppressing the defilements. Then, there being a suitable basis, one is capable of realizing any state realizable by direct knowledge toward which one might incline one's mind. So, delightfully complex, but you get it, you know? You can see how things are. But this kind of stepwise thing we're talking about is one way of looking at how we get there. And it really, to me, it really empowers, you know, in the muck of daily life, if we have the attitude of heading in that direction, that's where it's going. And maybe even this lifetime. Maybe even this lifetime. And then right at the end, he makes a connection. He calls the training in higher wisdom the third urgent matter for a monastic. And his higher wisdom is directly seeing the nature of things. Seeing, you know, through the illusion that we get caught in. And we project selfhood on the things. And then the self of me wants the good stuff and we don't want the bad stuff. And we're caught in attachment and aversion and ignorance. And that's, by the way, just as a slight aside, for those of you who studied Anapanasati, the 16 steps, the last three are dispassion and then cessation. And then this word, I don't remember the Pali word, but it can be translated as throwing back. Like you don't even want it anymore. You throw it back. It's really cool. You know, so it kind of is a parallel to what we're talking about here. Dispassion, cessation, just not being grabbed anymore. And then throwing back, and dispassion is not being tugged, and then you're not grabbed, and then you throw it back. So this, you know, this urgent training in virtuous behavior and higher mind, virtuous higher behavior and higher mind and higher wisdom, they're all intertwined and it's all sequential. And they build on each other. And, you know, it's like start where you are. Wherever we are is a good place to be doing it. And the last thing I'm going to read here, the Buddha said, when the dust-free, stainless Dhamma eye arises in the noble disciple, then, together with the arising of vision, the noble disciple abandons three fetters, personal existence, view, doubt, and wrong grasp of behavior and observances. So let's sit for a moment.